All right, so we left off last time around the 250s, and we're the second half of the third century is kind of quiet. You know, there's not a whole lot of major figures, major controversies. It was a period of relative peace. And I'm trying to get us up to the time of Constantine, because that's when things kind of start picking up again a little bit. But in order to understand Constantine, we got to understand some of the political happenings before that, how we got there. And we also got to talk about a couple of major persecutions that happened right before. And as it often is in the great books and stories and movies, it's always darkest right before the dawn. And so we got to kind of get to that point in our discussion. But we haven't talked much about persecution throughout this entire time. And so what I wanted to do was kind of take this opportunity to kind of go back and talk about some persecution. Because a lot of times when people talk about early church history, they think martyrs, Christians being thrown to the lions. It's a central theme, and we actually haven't talked about it much. And so I want to kind of reel back. We're going to kind of take a brief overview of persecution in the early church, and we should be able to end with Constantine. We are in chapter 6 of the book. We're kind of flying right through. We're kind of on track. We might be able to finish it by the end of the year. We'll see. So persecution. And the first thing, and we got a couple pictures up here. This was just my cover slide. We have, this is a depiction of the persecution happening during Nero, where Nero's persecutions depicted a lot of mockery. And so they'd put a cross there, and you see all the martyrs gathering around while the lions are over here in the background. Here you have these side vestibule entrances that would, you know, they would be held down here, and then you can't really see it because the slide here, but there's actually a Roman soldier there. They're kind of dragging people out, and that's another famous depiction. And then up here we have a depiction of Blandina, and I'll talk about her in a few minutes. That's the handout that you received when you came in. But to start with, we need to understand what has kind of been the normal, ordinary rule of law for most of church, early church history. What we have with Nero early on and Domitian was kind of a bit of an outlier. Nero, it was the fire in Rome, 64 AD. We kind of talked about that. There was a cause. There was a reason that kind of kicked that off. But generally speaking, persecution was not the norm. It would spring up periodically, sporadically here or there. Different regions would experience persecution. It wasn't typically the norm. And this is because of Pliny the Younger's letter to Emperor Trajan. And this was written around 112. And so Pliny, he's a governor up in Bithynia in the Asia Minor region. And what he does is he writes to the emperor saying, hey, I've got these Christians. They're kind of becoming more numerous. They're kind of starting to upset the local order around here. They're not really seeming to fit in with society. What do I do with them? I've caught some of their deacons and their deaconesses, and I've held them on trial. I've kind of whipped them and persecuted. How far should I take this? And so he's a good middle manager, and he goes straight to the top and says, I need explicit detail. And Trajan writes him a letter back, and we have this in the records, but he basically gives back four pieces of advice. And the first is, don't go around looking for Christians. If you find them, if they're causing trouble, you know, round them up, but don't go seeking these guys out. We're not going to make it empire-wide policy to go out and, you know, kick down doors at homes and things like that. Second would be, if the accused are found guilty of being a Christian, right? You gotta ask them, you gotta have a trial, you gotta do this in the orderly Roman fashion that we've come to expect. Then there's gotta be a punishment. And usually that punishment would be some kind of fine. If they were very belligerent, you know, you might lose a finger or a hand or something. You might be exiled. Rarely would they actually kill you. That was not normally what was required there. But if the accused deny that they're Christians and they show proof that they're not being, that they're worshiping the gods, if they're doing Roman things, then you got to acquit them. You can't do anything to them. They're Roman citizens. We don't harm our citizens. If they can offer some incense to the emperor or they can offer a sacrifice to the gods, they should be good to go. Let them go. No further questions asked. And so it's a fairly tolerant policy here. And finally, you're not supposed to be entertaining anonymous accusations. If you got somebody in the town, it's like, hey, I think my neighbor next door is a Christian because they got their lights on and they're meeting at like odd times of the night and there's always like small group happening over there. You can't just take these accusations and just go run hog wild with them. You got to have some substance. We're not starting a witch hunt here. And so Trajan kind of sets out the standard for how the Roman Empire would deal with Christians for the next 150 years. And so this kind of became standard empire-wide policy. And what you would have is not necessarily emperors so much persecuting Christians. It was local governors that got a little bit of a power trip, and they would find causes that they did not like, that Christians were involved in. They would then persecute the Christians. Now, there were some emperors that did persecute Christians, and I've got them listed here. And just a off note here, I think it's really important for us to kind of recognize what's going on here with persecution, even in our day. I think there's sometimes a tendency in the church to kind of say, oh, well, it's this grand conspiracy. They're out for the Christians. They're out for, you know, people of faith. Most of the time, it's not a grand conspiracy. Most of the time, it's pragmatism. Now, the grand conspiracy that pushes, why is it always the Christians, though? Why isn't it the Jews? Why isn't it the Muslims, right? Why is it always the Christians? It's because that's coming from Satan, right? And we got to understand the source of this is not these human emperors. It's not these localized governors. There is spiritual warfare that is happening. And we got to focus our minds on that, because what I've seen is sometimes we fail to understand the source of where persecution happens in our lives, and we end up demonizing, oh, it's this political party, it's this leader, it's this person. A lot of times they have very little to do with it, and we got to understand that we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, right? We are in a spiritual conflict, and the source is ultimately not these guys. It's greater than that. And I think that's just really important for determining our level of political involvement against Rome, right, in our day. And what I'm really proud of when I look back and I study church history in this period, there's no major Christian revolts. There's no party against, you know, Caesar. There's no massacre that happens where, you know, they just kill a bunch of Roman troops. It's very calm. It's very orderly. And what you have is you have Christians humbly submitting to the persecution, minding their own business, working with their own hands, and following the examples in Scripture. And what you see is great obedience to the New Testament in how they went through this persecution. And I think it's something that we can all learn. I think sometimes in our context, we say, oh, We gotta have the militia ready, right? Because when they come rounding up, I'm gonna be locked and loaded. And no, that's not how these Christians endured. We have to give them great credit for their humility and their endurance to suffer through these persecutions. And what we see is it also produces in those churches great purity. And I think we've talked about, you know, we talked about Tertullian, all right? He seems like a little bit of a legalist. We talked about some of these other people where they had these very strict moral standards. We kind of look at them and we say, oh, that's very different than what we see in the church today. And I think we got to keep in mind that these persecutions hardened these churches for upright moral behavior, that they were purified, and they focused on the essentials, which was godly living. And we can learn a lot from them. And I think those areas, you know, as I've said, in the early church, they're going to have some weird ideas. We're not going to agree with everything. I think we got to extend them a lot of grace because they were going through a lot of things that we have never experienced. Yes, Tom. Yes.
I'm not in for this. Whoa, I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not very many tares amongst the wheat during those days.
Right, right. And it's clarifying, right? It causes you to focus on the essentials. It purifies the church of those who really are in it for the wrong reasons, right? Good point. We've got Nero here in 64, and like I said, that was kind of a localized persecution. It was centered around Rome, and there were exiles, there were martyrs. We talked about that one. Then we had Domitian, and we talked about that. That's when John was exiled to Patmos. We talked about that when we covered that period. That was towards the end of Domitian's rule, and he kind of had a empire-wide, hey, we should start persecuting the Christians here. And then we got Marcus Aurelius. Marcus Aurelius, according to most people, was like one of the most upstanding. He's the philosopher emperor, right? Everybody, oh, Marcus Aurelius, he's got such good things to say. You know, we like him. He sounds noble-minded. He was a philosopher, and he was a very, very big hater of Christians. And you can kind of see the gap there. 96 to 161, it was an era of relative peace, small localized persecutions. Marcus Aurelius comes on the scene, and he doesn't necessarily send out edicts against Christians, but he kind of turns a blind eye to people running wild in these localized persecutions. And some of the worst persecutions early on happened under Marcus Aurelius. And your handout today comes from 2,000 Years of Christ's Power. That is excerpts in there from Eusebius, who records the story of Blandina. And Blandina is a slave girl up in France. And if you remember when we talked about Irenaeus, right? I said Irenaeus was from that France region. And he goes down to Rome, and then he comes back. And while he was away, there was this great persecution that happened. That was under the reign of Marcus Aurelius. And Blandina was a slave girl, and her master was a Christian, and she too was a Christian. And she was probably in her 20s. And what you have back there is the story of Blandina's martyrdom and her encouragement to the other Christians that were getting martyred with her. And it's a really moving story. And it's just incredible that you have this slave girl who doesn't have this great theological foundation. All she does throughout her entire thing is she continues to repeat over and over again, I'm a Christian, we have done nothing wrong. And that's her testimony. And she has been an encouragement to martyrs all throughout church history since that time. And so I hope that's an encouragement to you. You can find that in the book if you have the book, but I figured not everybody has the book, so everybody should know the story of Blandina. Next we get Septimius Severus, 193 to 211, and he issues several edicts. We get Maximinus the Thracian from 235 to 238, and these were emperor-wide persecutions, but they were all very short-lived. You can see here, you got 3 years here that he was reigning. So it was about a year of persecution there. And I'm sorry, these are mostly reigns, except for AD 64. These are the years that they reigned. And so, as I had stated before, a lot of these persecutions in the sovereignty of God were very short-lived. Sometimes they were very intense, but God would allow these things to happen, and then he would squash them. These things typically did not carry on very long. However, in 249, and this is kind of the period that we talked about a little bit last week, 249 to 251, we have Decius. And Decius kind of changes the game. Beyond being just, okay, here's some emperor-wide, we don't like Christian edicts, localized government persecutions, he actually sets about to returning to empire worship and the Roman pagan god worship. And he wants to restore the glory of Rome. And what he does, and before I get to the next slide, he actually comes up with a certificate here. And this is one of these certificates that they had to sign, basically saying, I, so-and-so, offered incense to Caesar and to this local deity, and I love the gods and worship them, and I will never worship Christ again, basically. And then they would sign it. And then there would be a Roman signature here and a second Roman signature there, validating that they observed the sacrifice happen. And we mentioned briefly last time, there were fake certificates that were getting purchased by Christians who they said, I don't want to offer incense to Caesar, but I'm going to, you know, bribe a local authority to be able to get my certificate so I can show, say, hey, look, see, I'm okay. And there was a lot of backlash in the churches for Christians that did that. And that was a controversy. But we got to understand part of Decius's reasoning here. So this is the Roman map in 117 AD, and you can see almost all this Persian area, all the way up here in France, all of Britain, all of Spain. This is the height and the extent of the Roman Empire. That's in 117 AD. Trajan was in charge here, and now we've got Decius, and Decius is now ruling this. Now, I found this map. This is a little bit complicated. I don't know what this is from, but basically, this is the time that Decius was there, and you can see this purple area. This is the Roman Empire, and so the Persians have pushed in over here, and you have all the Goths and the Visigoths. They're pushing down. And then you have this actual breakaway piece of the empire over in Gaul that was kind of part of the empire, but kind of not. And so the Roman Empire is in decline. It's crumbling. It's got people pushing in from every side. And there's a lot of political intrigue happening during this time. And what the response from the emperors was we got to get back to the glory of Rome. We gotta reinstate the old gods worship. All this trouble here is because of the Christians. And if we can just go back to worshiping the right gods, the gods will bless us. And the reason that we have so many defeats in battle and we got enemies on every side is because we are not worshiping the right God. Too many of our citizenry is become apostate. And so he wants to move to traditional Roman values. And this persecution starts in 250 AD. And almost instantaneously, there's about 3,000 martyrs. And this left a massive impact in the minds of the church. Everybody had to sacrifice to the gods. If you didn't, you were executed. It's lasted about 18 months of intense persecution. And this had a big effect on the church. There was a lot of churches that you knew multiple people in your church that had been hauled off and executed. Most of the bishops had to be replaced after this time because they were the first ones to go. Back to this. After Decius, we had Valerian. And Valerian was actually away fighting the Persians. He was over here fighting the Persians for his entire rule. And he was even worse than Decius. He's not even home, and he's writing letters back to the Senate at Rome saying, hey, I want you guys to put in these edicts. I want you guys to start persecuting the Christians. And in 258, he ordered that all the bishops be put to death. And this is kind of what we talked about briefly last week, Cyprian of Carthage. He was the most notable of those who were put to death under Valerian. And not only did he go after Christian churches and Christian bishops, he started going after wealthy Christian senators and wealthy Christian landowners. And this was something that had not been done in the past. Once again, they're trying to get back to the glory of Rome, and they're trying to purify that upper class of the Roman culture. And so Christians, all of a sudden, it meant something to be a Christian if you were a Roman citizen. Your titles, your land would be stripped away. Your property would be seized. And thankfully, this didn't last very long, because while he was over here fighting, he was captured by the Persians, and his son took over. And his son hated his father. And so his son just abandoned his father over there and basically said, everything that my father was doing, we're going to just do the opposite. And so they just dropped all the persecution under his son, Gallienus. So that was, we're going as fast as we can here. We got some history to slog through this morning. I apologize. But that was up to about 258. And then we have the second half of the third century becomes relatively peaceful. And it becomes peaceful because the military situation at this time was very tense. There was a lot going on. They had to be looking at the borders. They were not focused internally. And so during this time, and I'll just mention off to the side, we're now kind of the latter half of the third century. During this time, there was a missionary known as Gregory the Illuminator. And he's got a really interesting backstory. But he ends up going, I'm a little bit all over the place here this morning. He ends up going over here to Armenia. And he was originally from Armenia, was exiled to Rome for a while, comes back. And in 300, he ends up converting the king of Armenia to Christianity. And Armenia becomes the first Christian nation to actually have Christianity as its national religion. And so because of Gregory the Illuminator, we have Asator that we support here as our missionary. And so Armenia is the oldest Christian nation in the entire world because of this time of peace where missionaries were able to go out and they were able to do some of that. So that's Armenia. I just figured that was a little side note fun since our missionaries to Armenia are very important here to us. So now we get to Diocletian, and most of you guys have probably heard of Diocletian. Diocletian's name is a terror to Christians. And Diocletian came onto the scene in 284. And he was formerly a Roman soldier who was fighting off in those Persian wars. His commanders died. He kind of rose through the ranks and declared himself to be emperor while he was abroad. And he's got a whole army at his back. And we got to keep in mind that in Roman succession for their emperors, it wasn't this neat thing. Like, there was an election every year. It wasn't like, oh, we have a family dynasty and it's so-and-so's son just becomes the emperor. A lot of times it was very bloody. There was a lot of intrigue. This is the kind of political intrigue that George R.R. Martin and HBO can't even come up with. It's pretty intense. But Diocletian comes onto the scene, and Diocletian, for the most part, is actually a pretty good ruler. He's got some really good policies. He's a very able administrator, and he comes onto the scene, and the Christians think this is fantastic, because Diocletian had a wife named Prisca and a daughter named Valeria, and both of them were Christians. And so we're like, this guy comes onto the scene, he's going to be really generous to the church because his wife's a Christian. And so things start out fine, but Diocletian kind of views himself as a restorer of Rome's former glory, and he's got a real knack for doing that. and he was really good at ruling. And so what he did is he takes Rome and he divides it into East and West, and he kind of uses these terms, Augustus and Caesar, to refer to his titles. And so he says, all right, I'm going to be an Augustus, and I'm going to rule the East, and I'm going to have a second ruler who's going to kind of rule the West, and he'll be called an Augustus too. I'm kind of like the top Augustus, and he's like my co-Augustus. And then underneath them would be Caesars. And so Diocletian's in the East, and he has a Caesar under him that's ruling another part of the territory named Galerius, and he is the Caesar for Diocletian. And then he appoints a guy named Maximinian in the West, and he puts a guy underneath him as his Caesar named Constantius. And Galerius, you guys remember Lord of the Rings, the king? He's like, his mind's demented, and he's got the guy, he's like whispering stuff in his ear. Galerius is kind of like that guy. I think his name was Wormtongue. Galerius is always trying to whisper into Diocletian's ear. He's like, you got to start up the persecution. If you want Rome to be really great, you got to start persecuting Christians. And so Galerius gets in his ear, and in 302, Diocletian puts out an edict that's a general persecution of Christians. Everybody's got to offer the incense. And his wife and his daughter comply. And that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. And then there was this nationwide, empire-wide persecution. And he was even a little bit apprehensive to start this. And so what he does is he goes to the oracle of Apollo, and he gets advice from this pagan oracle. And he says, yeah, of course, I'm a pagan oracle. Of course, persecute the Christians. And so he issues his first edict, and it's that all Christian buildings were to be destroyed, all Bibles burnt, and all Christian worship forbidden. We lost a lot of early church Christian documents due to this first edict. And
when you say his wife and daughter complied, what do you mean? They renounced their faith?
They offered sacrifices and renounced their faith, yeah. And then the second edict followed shortly after. All Christian clergy were to be arrested and imprisoned. Third edict was all clergy were to offer sacrifices to the gods or be tortured. And then finally, all citizens through the empire were to sacrifice to the gods and be executed if they refused. And so it got progressively worse. And the persecution worsened because Diocletian ends up getting sick, and he steps aside. And Diocletian actually only had plans to be emperor for like 24 years. And so he says, I'm not feeling good. I'm kind of done with this. I'm getting older. I got to resign, but I don't want there to be political instability. And so I'm also going to make Maximinian resign. And so he steps aside, and he then gives the emperorship to Galerius and to Constantius. And so Galerius and Constantius then become the new Augustuses. And because he gave it to Galerius, Galerius was kind of under Diocletian. Diocletian had the rule. Galerius becomes the first amongst equals of these new Augustuses. And so here we got Diocletian, Maximinian. So now Galerius is the Augustus, and he's the one that was always pushing for the persecution. The persecution worsens. He's sending Christians out to stone quarries. He's doing all sorts of things. The Christians in the stone quarries actually start putting together churches there, and they start having Bible studies in the stone quarries while they're being persecuted. And so he starts persecuting them even harder. And so what we see is we see a church that is enduring under these persecutions, and they're doing very well. In the sovereignty of God, the persecutions under Valerian and Decius prepared them for this. They were like, we've been through this. Our parents have been through this. We know what this is like. And they endured much better under Diocletian and Galerius than they had prior. There wasn't as much of the bowing out, the buying the certificates. Most of the Christians here stood their ground and suffered the consequences. So here's where we got to get into a little bit more of the history here in the time that we have left, because we got to press on to Constantine. So Galerius is now the Augustus in the east, and Constantius is the Augustus in the west. Galerius appoints Caesars for both of them. So he appoints himself Maximinus Daya in the east, and he appoints a guy named Severus in the west. Now, both of these guys are loyal to Galerius. And Constantine is Constantius Chlorus's son. And Constantine actually was captured for a long time and spent a long time in Galerius's house. He was a household prisoner of Galerius because there was worry that one of these days, Constantius is going to get out of line, and he's got a son who's fairly able. He might be a problem. And so he tries to break up this line here. And this is another map. For you Roman history nerds, if there's any of you out there, I'm sorry, I'm doing such a poor job just blowing through this stuff. I want to get to Constantine so I can talk about the Arian controversy next week. So we're going to go blow through this. But there are people that make these maps. I find these maps online. People really nerd out about this stuff. It's exciting to some people. So the division of, we got Galerius over here, and he's kind of in the east. We have Constantine and Constantius up there with Severus over in the France region. And down here we've got Galerius's guy, Maximinus Daius. And this is kind of the division of the land here, just so you can kind of put a couple things together.
Did they start to expand again?
Yeah, under Diocletian, he won back a lot of what was lost under that time under Valerian. Okay, we'll get to that. So during this time here of Galerius, he eventually gets sick as well. And he is a persecutor of the Christians. And the Christians are saying, well, look, God got you sick. You're sick because you've been persecuting the church. And Galerius is actually kind of a superstitious guy. And he actually has a change of heart on his deathbed. And he's like, maybe I have been wrong. And so what he does is he, 5 days before he dies, he issues what's called the Edict of Serdica, which says, wherefore, for this our tolerance, they, the Christians, ought to pray to their God for our safety and for that of the Republic and for their own, that the Republic may continue uninjured on every side and they may be able to live securely in their homes. So Galerius, at the end of his life, changes course and says, hey, I'm sick, please pray for me. And what a testimony that is to ask the people that you're persecuting, can you pray for me? Right? It tells you that these Christians were enduring well under their persecution. So we got to get to Constantine here. Now, Galerius ended up having problems with this guy, Maximinus. If we remember, Maximinus was loyal to Galerius, but then we got this other guy, Maxentius. Right? They all named Max, right? But Maxentius is Maximinian's son. Remember, Maximinian was the other Augustus with Diocletian. And he's saying, hey, I should be the new Augustus. And so Maxentius starts war against Maximinus Daya and Galerius. And that gives Constantius, who got sick, he wasn't doing too well, that puts Severus in a very weak position. And Constantine comes up against Severus and takes the Augustusship in the west. And so Constantine is over here. He's biding his time in the west, and Galerius and Maximinus Daya are fighting Maxentius. To add to this complication, there's another guy named Licinius, and Licinius is actually the guy that Galerius replaced, because he's like, well, I don't have an Augustus anymore. My Augustus revolted against me, so now I need to appoint a new Augustus named Licinius. And so we have Galerius, Maximinus Daya, and Licinius, and they're fighting against Maxentius. And Maxentius has Rome, and Maxentius has a lot of support, and Maxentius is more powerful than these two put together. Because these guys have people on the east pushing in. They got the Persians, they got the Goths coming down. Like I said, George R. R. Martin cannot touch this stuff. So Constantine takes over the Augustusship on his father's side, and he decides, I'm going after Maxentius. Maxentius has Rome, I'm going down, I'm going to take Rome. And so he gathers all his forces up in France and pushes down across the Alps into Italy, and he meets Maxentius at the Milvian Bridge. And you guys might have heard this from classic literature, or some people in church history have referenced the Milvian Bridge. It's this watershed moment. And the night before the battle, Constantine, who at this point is a worshiper of the sun cult, Sol Invictus, never had any Christian influence necessarily, goes to bed, has a dream in the middle of the night, and he sees this sign in the sky, and he hears the words, "In this sign you will conquer." And he wakes up a new man. And this sign is called the Kairo. And you can see here, this is the Greek word for Christos, right? These are the first two Greek letters in the word. And that Kairo sign, it's the two Greek letters put together, was something that was used in early Christianity. And here you can see the Kairo. These are from catacombs in Rome, where they would have that Kairo inscribed, designating that this is a Christian site. And here you have a Kairo on this marker here with the Alpha and the Omega next to it, that Christ is Alpha and Omega. So this Kairo was a sign that was in use by early Christians. And he sees this sign in his dream, and he says, I'm going to conquer in this sign of Christianity. Now, the next morning, he wakes up, and he goes to all of his generals, and he's like, tell all your guys, you're painting this on the shield. And so these guys paint the Kairo on their shield, and they go out to battle against Maxentius and his troops. And they meet at the Milvian Bridge, and Maxentius actually falls off the bridge in the water. And you can see him here. He's got the crown. You got Constantine. And this is a later depiction, because this moment was heralded by the church as God's deliverance from some of the worst persecution that the church had ever encountered. And you see up on top here, the angels are directing the battle. And this was a major turning point. Now, people say, well, was Constantine saved at that moment? Constantine is a very complex character, and we're going to talk about him. But what we do see with Constantine is an immediate change in his favorability towards Christianity. And he won a decisive victory over that day, and within a few years was able to consolidate the entire Roman Empire under his rule. And he becomes the sole Augustus and ushers in an era of peace and toleration with Christianity. And eventually he meets, this is within a year or so after taking the Milvian Bridge and taking Rome, defeating Maxentius, he comes down and he issues this Edict of Milan. He gets together with Licinius, who is the other guy, who is the other Augustus. And he says, hey, we're going to be partners. We're going to be allies. We're going to go over, we're going to overthrow Maximinus Daya. And for our territories, we're going to officially stop all the persecution that happened under Galerius and Diocletian. And so that is a piece from Lactantius, and that is the Edict of Milan, that they met together and they declared peace in the empire for Christianity. Now, just wanted to throw a couple things up here, just closing remarks. John 15, 18 through 21, if the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. This is something we got to keep in mind when we're talking about persecution. It's not that the world hates us, they hate Christ. There's opportunity to hate us, and they're going to take that opportunity. But we got to stand firm knowing that we are not greater than our master. And when persecution comes, we're called to endure. And he's going to be with us, right? I've spoken to you that in me you may have peace. In the world you have tribulation, but take courage. I have overcome the world. This is our hope. Now, turning to modern times, we got to mention Nigeria. And I want you guys to, as you're thinking about church history, as you're thinking about this persecution, be aware of this stuff. Nigeria, in 2023, accounted for 82% of global martyrdom. That was just in the year of 2023. It's getting really bad over there. It's been bad over there since 2009. There's been 100,000 Christians martyred. This year alone, as of July, there were 7,000. That's like 3 months ago. No, more. that's a lot. These Christians, I was looking this up. There's a picture, and I didn't want to put it up here, but there's a picture out there of a young mother with three young children all hanging from a tree because they're Christians. This is happening in our day and age. And since this persecution by Boko Haram started back in 2009, there's been 18,000 churches burned. So pray for the church persecuted. Pray for the church in Nigeria that they would endure, that we would be able to have stories that come out of church history about their faith, about their endurance. And do what you can. You know, if you can partner with organizations to send money, send Bibles, send resources, do it. It's needed. These are our brothers and sisters who are being burned and tortured. It's not done. In this world, we will have persecution. We will have tribulation. And this has been true since the early church, and it's still true today. So, but we don't put our hope in human rulers like Constantine or Donald Trump or anybody else. Our hope is in Christ, because he is going to take us to the end. And there's all those martyrs in Revelation underneath the altar saying, how long? It's a little while longer, and we're gonna make it. All right? Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your comfort, for your Holy Spirit that guides us, gives us courage and endurance, that we would persevere to the end. Be with the church in Nigeria. Give them boldness. Give them faith. Help them to endure and hold fast to Christ. Amen.